From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour will be made tonight at Knox Cocktail Lounge in Rochester. You've heard of the Eat Local movement, the Drink Local movement. Well, this is the Read Local movement, created to offer support for books with local ties. And tonight at 6 p.m. at Knox, the newest and the first Read Local event brings, naturally, someone from Denmark. What is going on here? This is Read Local, and I'll explain, you see. In fact, the author coming in tonight is a woman who's been described as the Virginia Woolf of her native Denmark. Josephine Klaugaard's latest work is called One of Us is Sleeping. It's a novel, sort of, but really it defies the genre, taking you inside the narrator's psyche, which has been scarred by loss of various kinds. And as I read the book, I found myself wondering, how do you so successfully translate a book from Danish to English like this? You know, I'll read a section or two during this hour, and you will see what I saw, which is it is beautifully lyrical. But you're reading it in the second language it's ever been in. I just find that remarkable. So I'll tell you who's at least responsible for bringing the book to the United States and who does a lot of work in this regard. Open Letter Books. They do about, what, 10 books a year or so? And they take works from other countries, publish them right here. And my guests are going to be able to discuss this book, One of Us is Sleeping, as well as the event tonight and the whole mission of the Read Local movement. So fun way to end the week. Let me welcome our guests to the studio from Denmark. Josephine Klaugaard, the author of One of Us is Sleeping. Congratulations on this book and thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
And Jakob Sandvad is here. He is the editor of the book. Is that right, Jakob?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, welcome to you as well. Thanks
thank
for being
you.
Here. Kyle Semmel is the executive editor, executive director of Writers and Books. I gave you an editor title. You're not an editor. You are a translator as well, and we'll talk about that. Nice to see you as well.
Thank you for having me.
Chad Post is the publisher of Open Letter Books. Chad, welcome back to you.
Thanks.
10 books a year or so for you guys still, right?
Exactly.
Okay, yep. And a book like One of Us is Sleeping is one of how many that you consider for publication?
We probably consider about 100 books a year.
Wow.
So it's a very slim percentage that makes it through into actually being published. And that's not counting like books that you just hear about at book fairs such as the Frankfurt Book Fair or the London Book Fair that you hear about and you're like, nah, that doesn't really fit us. But the ones that we're taking seriously, there's probably like, yeah, closer to 100.
And I wonder, Chad, some books like Josephine's, this is someone who I, you know, like most Americans, hadn't heard of her work. Then you start reading her work. You start reading the praise for her work, the way critics talk about her in Europe. And you think there's so much buzz and respect for her. Is there a competitive market for Open Letter competing with others that want to do this too?
There sort of is now more than ever. About 15 years ago, there started to become more of a movement in America with publishing in the literary world to pay attention to international works. That for a long time, I mean, the standard figure is that 3% of all books published in America are in translation. And for a long time, people were like, well, that's fine. And then Words Without Borders, Open Letter, Archipelago Books is another example. Deep Bellum is a newer press that's also publishing Josephine that became dedicated to doing international works to try and open up the communication between American writers and readers and the rest of the world. We'd become very isolated. So now there maybe is more, but nevertheless, there's so many good books that exist in the world. We can, yeah, it's you can find really good writers in any country that you go to.
And you and how many have to decide on which 10?
It's like two people.
It's amazing. It's a lot of reading.
Yeah.
And I'm sure great fun, but a great challenge and a lot of responsibility. And so you've got this event tonight. It's at 6 o'clock at Knox and it opens up Read Local. So we're talking about international books, but it's Read Local. And Kyle, tell me about what this idea, this movement is supposed to be.
Well, it starts with when I first came here and with my background and as a translator, as a writer, and having lived outside of this area for many years, I'm always aware of BOA. BOA is something that has been here for so long. And Open Letter, too, in the last 10 years or so, Open Letter has been doing fantastic work. And there is such a, with Open Letter, it's like internationally known, wonderful press that publishes so many works of literature and translation. And those two organizations were two organizations that I really wanted to say, okay, let's do something together, because you guys here locally, I mean, I've had people ask me, you know, Open Letter, what is Open Letter? Or, you know, when my one of my translations was actually published by Open Letter 3 years ago, I think.
Last year. Last wow. September.
Last year. Feels like so long ago. and so when I said, you know, yeah, the publisher's actually in Rochester, like they didn't know that there was a publisher in Rochester that did translation and did it to the level that Open Letter does. And so I felt this was a great opportunity, and especially since I knew that Josephine was publishing this fall and that she was coming over, that, hey, this was a great opportunity to do some work with Open Letter and Writers and Books. And so we met with Peter Connors as well at BOA, and we kind of tied this into the idea that this is about two great local presses who are nationally recognized, internationally recognized, but yet sometimes in Rochester maybe not as recognized as they should be. And so it felt like a natural marriage between the three organizations. And, you know, again, this is something that if it works, if it takes off, you know, there may be other presses locally that we could also bring into this. And it's just, these are the two that I knew that I wanted to work with right from the get-go. And it seemed like a good time to start with kind of some beta tests, so to speak, for this.
All right, so we're going to jump into the book in a second here. Before we do that, Chad, you want to add something?
Yeah, I want to add something to that. One of the things that, so we had this meeting to talk about founding Read Local, and part of the energy that came out of that meeting was the idea that, like you said, that the presses that publish books, the books are read all over the world. They're not necessarily linked to a specific area, but we also wanted to find some way of engaging with an audience and with the readers here in a way that's fun and more, and that's outside of the norm. So rather than if you think of a reading or like a poetry reading or any book reading, you think of it like being sort of stayed in a library, sort of dry, someone talks for a while and then they go away. And we wanted to try and engage with the public. So like the Read Local postcard that you have includes like basically like grab the book, read the book, have it meet the author, have a drink with the author. And we're trying to encourage and work with local businesses. So the partners for this first event include Hearts, Local Grocers, Knox, Three Heads Brewing, Greenwood Books, and different areas in which they're all selling the book. And those are places that don't yet usually have books for sale. So if you go into Three Heads Brewing and you see one of us is sleeping and they're saying like, here, you should come to this event, you can meet the author, so on and so forth. We're trying to get people that move readings out of like the way that people conceive of them and make them more enjoyable and fun. So if you come out tonight, you'll see that Josephine's going to read for a bit, but she's also going to hang out with you and have a drink with you.
Knox is a really cool place. I was there for the first time recently. I think it's only been open for about a year or so.
Yeah,
it's a really great space right across from Village Gate. Easy to find. Goodman. Is that technically Village Gate?
Mm-hmm.
Village Gate's on the other side, or is that all Village
Gate? It's all Village
Gate. Okay, so it's in Village Gate. Thank you, Chad, for that. It's on Goodman. It's easy to find. And at 6 p.m. tonight, it is free.
Yep.
So you kind of describe what you don't want it to be, what you do want it to be. What do you envision tonight? Someone comes out tonight at 6 p.m., what's going on?
I think that there's going to be a mix. Well, Josephine will read. We'll talk a little bit about the book. And then I think that there'll be questions and answers from people who have read it or haven't read it or just have questions. And then we'll all kind of mingle and have an enjoyable time together. So it's less of like a formal event in that sense and more of like an opportunity to engage and to talk to readers and to talk to each other so that they're to involve the reading community as a whole.
6 p.m. tonight. We love books. What a neat idea this will be. People who love literature. And you'll get to meet Josephine Klaugart. And Josephine, I'm a little worried about you. This book made me very sad at times. And I don't know how autobiographical it is. Beautiful, but very, well, why don't you take us through, you know, how you create a book like this. Tell us a little bit about the main person involved and sort of the basic structure and frame here.
Oh, yeah. So I always work this way, that I have like one document open on my computer, and that's where everything I write goes into. So that means also there's some sort of a diary as well. So I write every day, obviously, that's my work. And then I work for like a year or so, and I start reading back in this document. And I look for structures. I look for images that are reoccurring. I look for beautiful sentences, and then I try to compose the book. So it is, you know, it's very different from a writer or a novelist who make a crime story or so, where they have like a plot line first.
Yeah.
So I try to do it the other way around, and that's I think is a great way of working, because you're actually able to reach something that are wiser than yourself. You're able to surprise yourself. And that's what I like about literature. It should really be a shock for you and also for the writer. If it doesn't surprise the writer, the novelist, then it will definitely not surprise anyone else.
Well, that is certainly, you're right, unusual. I haven't heard that approach before, but it makes sense, especially once you pick up one of us is sleeping, because there are moments where I was a little confused about, wait a second, when is this? Where are we? Who is?
I know what you mean.
What's happening here? But that's sort of by design, isn't it?
Oh, yes, it is. It's not a chronological book. And the reason why I've made it this way, because I could have arranged the scene so that it will build a chronological timeline, plot line. But it is that I find this chronological structure a bit weird. I think that none of us, like, we don't experience our own lives that way.
Our memories are not built that way.
No, and right. Obviously we're, all us five people, we're in this studio right now in the present current time. But at the same time, we're constantly moving back and forth in time. So the mind of the human being, is this way. It functions this way. And that's one of the beautiful things about being a human being, that you can move, so your mind is so flexible. And I think it's so weird that for so long time, literature has just been chronological timeline, totally without, you know... I think the only way to, like, fully... grasp what a human mind is to work this way.
Well, can I ask your editor if he's okay with that? Because, I mean, Jakob, I mean, that it's a little more unconventional as an editor.
Yes,
you know, I haven't picked up a book that read like this, and I read a lot. As an editor's perspective, how much do you seek to let her have that freedom to take a character who, and we're going to talk about this person, lost love, losing a parent, going back to childhood home, feeling a bit like an outsider, all of these emotionally scarring or challenging things. And so I think she's right. I mean, we don't experience memory in perfectly chronological ways. How many of us have ever tried to think back to a term and said, I know that that's when it happened, and it turned out we're off by a year or a week or 5 years? So that's fascinating to me. But as an editor, you're more used to the chronological story. This happened, then this happened, then this happened, then the end. What's the challenge for you with this?
Well... the challenge is, it's obviously I have to read a lot because, it's about exploring, reading with Josephine, talking about the book a lot. I mean, trying to find out what's happening. What is beautiful here? What is important? What is this all about? So it's one long conversation, I would say.
Did you stop her at any point and say, this I just totally don't get?
No.
Okay.
No.
Oh, yeah, you did. You just forgot. Yeah. And then most of the time, I actually end up agreeing with Jakob, but some of the times I don't agree. And then I get to decide.
Well, yeah,
it's my book. So.
Yeah, it's... I'm just asking questions a lot of the time. What is this? What does this mean? How is this?
Mm. And talking about memory, I just wanted to add, it's one of the themes in the book, one could say, is also family. Family as like a war zone, because that's another aspect of memory being like this fluent thing. Mm-hmm. It's not stable construction. You kind of rebuild your own memory, your own past every day. Especially when something dramatic happens, as in this case, the mother turning ill and a love relationship ending, you have to remodel your past, and the thing with family is that you have to reach some kind of agreement when you are in a family, you build those mythologies actually around memories. And at the beginning, everyone has like his or her own version of things. And then to be able to live together in a family, one of the storylines has to be accepted by everyone. So this is like the war that goes on in all families until you reconcile about like, okay, this is the version, this is what we agree on. And I think that's so interesting because it reflects in the greater image as well. It's also a thing in societies. You have to reach an agreement of how to interpret the past. I think that's one of the big issues in this book, how to, find this story and to be able to live together in a family.
Well, we talked structure. Let's tell us about the main person in your book here. I sort of asked if it was autobiographical. I won't probe too deeply, but why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about the basic frame of what's going on in her life?
Yeah, she is a woman in her mid-20s, and she's just returning to her home village, visiting her family. And recently she has been left by two men, actually. First, the first man, who is actually called the dead man in the book, they had been together for a long time, I think 8 years. And then she had this short, intense relationship with the new man. But both of them are obviously leaving her, and she is devastated. And she, in order to find a home in the world again, she returns to a childhood home and find everything changed. So one of the dramatic changes is that the mother has cancer and will probably or maybe die from it. So the idea of the eternal mother, the one who's always there to support you, is questioned at this point. And as well, because the landscape plays a part in the book as well, an important part. So what she finds is that this very special landscape where the book takes place, it's called Mols Mountains. It's like a nature park in Denmark, actually. And it has undergone some dramatic changes over the last 10 years, I would say, because it's a beautiful landscape. It's a very dramatic landscape. Maybe it's not... Well, you wouldn't call them mountains, Denmark is kind of flat, but it's the most mountain.
They're mountains for Denmark.
Well, it's more like hills. But anyway, beautiful landscape. It's it was created in the Ice Age, where those big blocks of ice were pressing the landscape out in these beautiful forms. So, and when I grew up, because I did, I grew up in Mols Mountains, and when I grew up, the hills were covered with trees. It was like one big forest. It was so beautiful. And for a child, to be able to walk through those forests and just the landscape changed a lot. And and then there was this plan to bring the landscape back to a former state where there were no trees at all. So this is the landscape that she returns to, a landscape where all the trees are gone. And if anyone of you have seen a landscape that's recently, when all the trees have recently gone down, you know that it looks like a graveyard. It's so intense. It looks terrible. It's like an elephant graveyard or something like that. So she is obviously shocked to see this landscape again. And that kind of doubles the image of going back to a family where everything has been disturbed as well, because that's what cancer does to a family. I know many of you listening have cancer stories in your family, and you know that everything you believed in, everything that you knew from one day to another changes. So this is the state of mind she is. She's when we meet her, she's in shock, you would say, and grieving. She's in existential trauma, you could say.
I've heard you say in interviews that this, well, first of all, it's fiction, but it is not meant at all to be a simple how to deal with grief. By the end of the book, everyone has gotten over it, and they go out for ice cream, and it's great. That's not the case at all.
No.
And actually, I appreciated that very much, because you defied convention in that way. So if I could, it's a thrill for me to be able to talk to an author, because I get a chance to see more of your insight, and I get to see if the way your book made me feel is what it was aiming to do, or if I just missed everything. So I felt a number of things here.
Yeah.
First of all, intense sadness and sort of empathy for someone who's dealing with so much, not the least of which is when you've gone through these losses of relationship. Your mother is fighting cancer, and then everything at home has changed so much. So many of us at least like to be able to go home and feel that comfort, because it's familiar, and she doesn't even have that. Also, this sense occasionally for me of frustration that, okay, we've got to be a strong feminist and get out of this. You know, men do not define your life. You can rise above this, you know, and I'm like wanting her to get out of this malaise and that frustration. But of course, you know, that's me projecting a little and rooting. And then I think an appreciation that you didn't go for sort of an easy pat conclusion, that, which would have felt so out of place with it. And and I just, you know, what were you aiming to for people to feel?
But I think this is very much about what I think about literature, or in general, what is literature? And for me, literature is like a basic research in the question, what is it to be a human being? So that is why there are no simple answers here. I think I look at writing as at this uncanny, weird process of like trying to, through the details in the world, through this sensitive collection of the things around you, of the words that people say to each other, of the small movements you do all the time, throughout all this, like to answer questions that you didn't even know that you were answering, you were questioning. Mm-hmm. So this is the problem with literature, that kind of starts with a question. The writer say, okay, I want to know how to get over a broken heart. Right. So I write a book about that, how getting over a broken heart. I never ask myself those questions, because I know that the most interesting answers and the answers that I most, you know, that I deeply need to find, them I don't even dare to ask. So for me, my own books and a lot of other books that I write, written by different writers than me, other writers than me, they're like very sincere, very sensitive, very serious attempts to investigate and try to give different answers at one time of the questions that we don't even dare to ask. So, and that is why I continue writing all the time, because when I'm done writing a book, I become a reader. I become a reader of my own work. And that is the point where I look back and I become a reader, and I suddenly see that this book is answering some questions in a very like sensitive and not punchline-ish way, some questions that I didn't even know that I was asking myself all the time. So my own books and books by so many other writers, they are kind of revelations to me. They're putting a spotlight on something that I didn't know that I was looking for.
Do you think we need to embrace grief a little bit and sorrow, as opposed to, especially because in modern society it is so easy to escape real emotion with something technological or something to distract us? And your book is not about escaping that stuff. It's about sort of, at least it seems to be kind of diving into it.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because I used to say that it's an anti-coaching book. Because coaching, that's a result of society wanting us to be efficient. They want us to create value all the time, and value that you can measure. And literature doesn't produce any value that you can measure, at least not all the time. So in this way, I would say that all good literature and all the reading of good literature is an activism. It is the population saying, well, I don't want to be an efficient machine all the time. I don't want to be, producing value for society all the time. I want to be a human being, and that is it's so simple, and yet so difficult for us to say, because we're a part of society. This idea that everything you do should be measured and counted and kept on account, you know, it is influencing us in ways that we're not even beginning to understand. And that is why literature is so important. That is why it's so important that you guys work on, you know, getting this literature out to people. And I'm so happy to be a part of the thing tonight, because it's an example of something where we kind of invite people to come and experience literature in a non-formal way, because literature often is like difficult accessible because it has this there's this flair to it that is a bit boring, maybe not that important, and maybe that not interesting. Mm-hmm. But it can be, and so I think it's great that we do those events where we kind of embrace people and just come for an hour, you know, half an hour, just be there.
Well, know? Listeners, if you're just sort of popping into the conversation partway and saying, who is this woman that Evan is talking to? It's Josephine Klaugart, and her book is One of Us is Sleeping. That's her newest book, published by Open Letter, and she is in Rochester for this Read Local event that she just mentioned. It's tonight. It's free. It starts at 6 p.m. at Knox Cocktail Lounge at the Village Gate, and it's kind of the local version of the local food movement and local drink. It's Read Local because it's putting the spotlight on this local publisher that finds these authors around the world and makes sure their voices and their work is read, as Josephine said. I want to get our only break of the hour, and I want to come back and talk to her more about what it means as an author in Denmark to find a way to reach American readers and readers in different countries. Americans are a little we kind of forget that there's great literature around the world, as Chad Post has said for years. It's not just American authors. And I want to talk about the art of translation, too, if we could. Kyle Semmels here is with Writers and Books, but also a translator. And I found this book. I was amazed at how I almost never stopped myself and said, this feels a little stilted in any way. It just never happened. So I kind of want to move into that as well. One more quick question for the break here. It's right on the cover. Scandinavia now has its own Virginia Woolf. I've already said it. You've heard it so many times, Josephine. You're Josephine Klaugart. You're not Virginia Woolf. I mean, every writer is their own. That comparison, what does that mean to you, though?
Well, first of all, it's a bit funny, isn't it? Because, you know, how to compare writers, it doesn't make sense. But on the other hand, I'm a great fan of Virginia Woolf and obviously influenced by her work. So in that respect, I understand where the comparison is made, and I'm very honored and flattered and all that. But I think you just have to, like, be grateful and then smile at it.
Yeah, sure. There you go. Yeah. That's Josephine Klaugart. So we'll continue with her and with Jakob Sandvad, who is her editor, who's here, Kyle Semmel from Writers and Books, Chad Post from Open Letter Books. More straight ahead. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on the Next Connections first hour, we talk to local debate coaches and participants. It's the day of the first presidential debate. How do you prepare for debate? How do you prepare for the unexpected? How much research is too much? How do you come across as natural? We'll get ready for that first debate. Then second hour, the best and the worst movies about politics. Jack Garner and Les Friedman join us. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and we're talking to a group of folks who have brought Josephine Klaugart and this book here. Chad Post was just mentioning that Open Letter brings books. How many different countries this year? Because you're doing around 10 books a year.
Yeah, it's usually about 8 different countries. I'd have to look through.
Okay, so
them.
What are some of the examples? Offhand, top of your head.
Well, we have a book from a Spanish author, an Icelandic author, a Danish author, Brazilian author, a French author. We had a Tunisian author last year, so
that's
yeah.
Great, it's awesome. And
Chinese.
There's a Danish woman writer series, or tell me about how you kind of came to this one here.
Yeah, so the way that we found Josephine's book was, I think it was 3 years ago now, the Danish Arts Council funded a trip for myself and Kaja Straminus, who is our senior editor, to go to Copenhagen and to meet with publishers, editors, writers, reviewers to be able to find out about Danish literature. And after we were there, we came back with a ton of books that we were interested in, and almost all of them were written by women. So we talked to the Danish Arts Council about getting funding, because we're a nonprofit. We rely upon funding to be able to continue to bring these books. Like the marketplace, our books sell, some of them sell very well. They all sell fairly well, but you know, books are tough. They're a tough commodity to like make a living off of. So we're a nonprofit. We depend upon funding to be able to do what we do. And the Danish Arts Council agreed to help fund a series of doing 5 books from Denmark. And we wanted to turn that and not just make it 5 books from Denmark, but 5 books by women. Because one thing that we do at Open Letter, we have a website called 3% that's based on that statistic I mentioned. And in there is the translation database, where I track every book of fiction and poetry that comes out in translation for the first time ever. We have all the stats there. No one else has the statistics. No one else has this database. And it's available for free online. And by using that, we found that 26% of all books in translation published over the past 10 years are written by women, which is a horrendously low percentage.
Yeah.
And we can't change that by doing 10 books a year, but we can do something. And so we wanted, and we loved all these books by women, first of all. We loved the books that we were getting. And then we thought, this is a chance to be able to shine a light. So we're going to do 5 books all written by women authors or female authors over a 5-year period. And the first one came out last year, which was Naya Marie Eit's book, Rock, Paper, Scissors, which Kyle translated. And this is the second book that came out. And the third one, Justine by Eben Mondrup, comes out in December and is actually translated by another Rochester person, Carrie Pierce, who translates Danish books and Norwegian and Swedish and 7 other languages, I think.
Yeah, so great picture of what's going on. And Josephine, what does it mean to you as the writer, the author of this book, who, you know, look, we all write for different reasons, but for you, this is what you do. And you never know when you start a project how many people a book will, you know, how many hands are going to get their hands on your book. What does it mean to have this with Open Letter?
It means so much to me. Actually, I went to New York like 4 years ago, and I had my Danish version of the book in my hand. I thought, well, I'm just going to show this and the sample translation to a couple of people, then it will be a piece of cake to get it published here. And it obviously, it was a bit more difficult than that. But
I don't know what the publishing industry is like in Denmark, but...
But anyway... Yeah, I thought, you know, but it really surprised me that you can have like big success in a European country and people in the US will be like, well, Europe? So where's Europe? Yeah. Where is it? So, you know, it's sometimes a bit.
We know where Europe is generally. We just don't know what's within Europe.
No.
Josephine, you're being exceptionally modest about this too. Like, Josephine was the youngest author ever to have 2 books be finalists for the Nordic Council Literature Prize, which is the largest prize that you can get for Scandinavian writing. It includes like all the books that come out from 5 countries: Iceland, Sweden, Finland, Norway, and Denmark. So to be a finalist of the 5 books that they choose every year, just one time is amazing. To do it twice and to do that at the age of 30, correct? is astounding. So your reputation was gigantic.
But anyway, back to the question.
You're right. She's a deflector, Chad. Go ahead, Josephine.
The question, what it means to me is, I can hardly express it. It means so much to me. And to also just to have Martin Aitken's translation of the book is like an extra gift. I look at translation this way, that is, it's obviously another book. It's not the same book as a Danish book, but it's like sisters. So that you have like the same genetic, base, and then you're at the same time, you're completely different. So in that respect, it's an adventure to get to know this book.
Can I just read a couple of quick passages?
Yeah, please.
Because
do,
you know,
please do.
And you could pretty much in this book sort of flip anywhere, and it is, I don't think there's a cliche in the book. So what I want to do is I want to read just a couple of passages, and then talk about when Josephine says it's almost like it's not a different book; it's a separate book. But I want to get your sense as the writer, and I want to talk to Kyle as well about the art of translation. So here's just an example. Natural disasters don't distinguish between what is foreign and what is not. Nothing stays as you left it. The return home is impossible. One must reconcile oneself with the face that is foreign. The landscape doesn't miss you. The hills have not pined. To the hills, one person is no more or less foreign than another. All people are always both parts. There is always some recognition, something shared, and no one willing to be shunned in that way. Marginalized like foreign bodies, infants mixed up at birth, planets likewise confused. And maybe unreality is like that too, indifferent as to how much history and how recognizable. I mean, the flow of that is just, there's nothing at all that flags it for you as, I don't know, I mean, it's just, Kyle, someone who translates, didn't do this one, but I mean, that's the whole book, it's like this.
Yeah.
That's, to me, that's art. That's a great accomplishment.
Absolutely, and I think Josephine mentioned Martin Aitken, and he is, to me, probably the finest translator of Danish that you that is currently working today. He's just a wonderful translator, as you point out. His sentences flow with such wonder and beauty. And I actually visited him while he was translating this book, and so I saw it spread out on his desk, and it was, you know, we talked briefly about it, and I think, you know, it is a challenging book in some respects, and I think translating it and translating anything is always difficult, but a book like this is especially so. And I think in terms of just getting the sensibility of the book, you have to really, really understand what the book is doing. And that in some ways is more important than the words. And it's something when you're doing, say, a crime novel where it's a little different, but then you're doing something like this where it's poetry, it's stream of consciousness. It is a jumble of different things happening all at once. It requires a certain deftness of touch that is, you know, just not easy. And I joked to Martin that day. I said, you know what? I don't think I could do this book. I don't know if I have it in me to do a book like this. This is, it's a very challenging book to translate.
Yeah, well, I actually want to read the opening page, only because I go into this book, you know, I'd read a little bit on the background, and I don't read a whole lot of foreign foreign language books, but thanks to Chad Post, I read some. And that's what Chad's legacy in this town is, getting people who read a lot like me to get outside of our own country sometimes. So thank you for that, Chad. But the book just opens with that. I mean, here it is. The light comes creeping in over the plowed fields, slabs of dark clay soil thrust up in disorder, bull calves fighting in the stalls, the thud of too much body in a space too small, and the snow, so gently it lies now, upon the ridges, upon the landscape, everything living and everything dead. A coat of cold, a deep, reassuring voice. The landscape, naked, unsentimental. Here is the feeling of missing you, though no one to miss. A landscape of lace that is frost. I love that imagery, and I wonder what the author thinks of that, because you originally wrote that, and I don't know what the pure Danish translation, how close is that to the pure translation?
I would say it's actually
close.
Very close.
Very close.
Yeah, it is.
Is most of the book pretty close to the pure translation?
It depends on how you look at it, because some of the times it differs a bit. But what is closeness in this context?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
Are you trying someone? I had this road trip. I was in New York and I went for like upstate bed and breakfast.
What do you call that in Denmark?
The same.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, completely the same. So that was a problem. It didn't translate. Yeah. So yeah. No, but then at the breakfast, this man who owned the place, he was like, so you're trying to like find a good translator of the book, but have you heard about Google Translate? So he thought that you actually, if you just Google Translate the
work. Oh my goodness
work,
gracious, no way.
So, but that would be like a close translation in one way, because it would look at one word and then translate it into the most common translation of that word. But that wouldn't be a good translation, definitely not. But it would be, in some respect, it would be a close translation.
Yeah, sure. Technically but, close, but yeah.
So that is why it's actually an art form to be a translator. And in a way, you have to be an author yourself to be able to be to translate work like this, because you have to recreate it. You have like, you have this the basket of, as I was talking about before, genes. You know. You have those genetic rocks and bricks, and then you have to like put them together in a completely new way. So you have to have so much poetry in you. So it's terribly hard work, and I think that Martin has done like an amazing job.
Agree, Kyle.
I would completely agree, and I think that goes back to you really have to get the sensibility of a book. You have the galley copy of the book that's coming out, my translation of The Hermit by Thomas Rudell, which is a wonderful book, very different. It's a different style, but it's still, I feel that that book has its own challenges. Every book has its own challenge, and I enjoyed working on that, and I really like seeing how it looks there. But with a book like Josephine's or a book like Thomas's, it's just you really have to get into the book in a way that no reader, anyone reading this book, would be able to get into it as deeply as a translator would. I mean, you as a reader, you're also translating to a degree. You're translating what's written on the page. The words have different meaning for different people, but yet a translator is deep, deep into a text like that. And really, it is. It is an art form, and I think that is in Martin in this case, I think he was the perfect match for this book.
Are there phrases that don't translate? Danish to English, English to Danish.
There's one that I like, and this is something that I think epitomizes why translation can be difficult, how it can be difficult, and that's still a Tresco owner. So you get, you know, what we could say is, you know, kick the bucket or die, you know. We have so many ways of saying that, and it's about finding the right way for that book. Like, what is the voice of that book? Is it somebody who says kick the bucket? Is it somebody who says,
bought the farm?
Or what are some of our other phrases for that?
Those are the main ones.
Pushing up daisies. I don't know.
For example, and so it's that kind of thing, and then magnify that by how many words are in the book and how many different combinations of possibilities there are, which is why Google, that whole thing is absurd to me. It's comical.
Yeah, right. Sure, yeah.
Because it would be the worst book ever. and unreadable. So the sheer volume of words in a book can make it astronomically difficult.
And sometimes a direct translation makes no sense whatsoever. I remember being a camp counselor, and in my early Spanish-speaking days, had some campers down in Chautauqua Lake years ago, campers from Spain. And one of the American campers said something like, "This sucks." And the Spanish kids were like, "What?" And so I've said, "Well, it's chupar. You know, it's to suck." And they're looking at me going, "This doesn't make no sense at all in the Spanish language." The direct translation is, you know, it's sort of this vulgar, I don't like it, sort of English word, can't translate at all. And so that's why I just look at someone like Kyle or someone like Martin who did this book. To me, it's art. It really is art. And so I also wondered, Kyle, I don't ask how many books you've done. When's the first time you translated a book? How long ago? How many years have you been doing this?
11.
Okay. Do you remember the first book that you did, and was there any sort of feeling of terror that you're not going to produce a work that the author wanted?
My life is filled with terror. So, yes. I think that you have, every time you start a new project, you always, at least I do, I always say, okay, I don't want to mess this up. This is something that every time you start something new, it's like, how do I not mess this up? The way you not mess this up is you bury yourself deep in the book, and you pay attention to what it's saying and what it's telling you, so to speak. And so you do that, and you don't have time to worry about if you're messing it up. There's an element of that. But I started doing it basically because I really wanted to, and I had nobody asking me to do it. I just translated a story by a guy whose work I really admired, and I sent it to him. I said, "Hey, what do you think?" And it started that way, and it kind of just kept going and going. It was like one of those snowballs on a hill that just kept rolling down and got bigger and bigger and bigger until, you know, I have a book like The Hermit, or I've got another one next year coming out that I've already done, but it's coming out after The Hermit. So hopefully at this point I think that's it for me. But nevertheless, it started out that way. It's just I didn't have time to think about being afraid, really.
Does the author have any say in then getting that manuscript of translated book and then saying, "This doesn't work for me. This doesn't feel like a fit"?
It depends. And in some cases, authors want to be involved, and in some cases, they do not. Mm-hmm. Naya, for example, I think a great working relationship with her. She wanted to read it. She lives in Brooklyn. She speaks fluent English, and I would even say she speaks fluent American to distinguish that.
Sure, absolutely.
And so she wanted to see it. And what was funny with her is that she has a 10 or 12 year old son, at least at the time I was doing this work, and he said there was one phrase that I had translated in such a way that he said that it sounded like I was, you know, it was like, what, 50 or something like that. Because it was an old phrase. I forget what it was now, but it made me like, so this 12-year-old saying that that's just not cool anymore. So that was a moment when I realized that I'm not young anymore. I'm 40, you know? So, because that seemed really like a fine sentence. Whatever it was, I just remember thinking, wow.
And Josephine, did you want to be involved in that process? Are you pretty hands-on?
Yeah. So he asked me, what do you exactly mean with this? But most of the time, I wasn't as involved as I think Naya was, actually.
That's true.
No, you probably weren't. No. But some authors, you know, I've had with Thomas, for example, the Hermit, I asked him, I sent him one email with like 6 questions from the entire book. Because if I do that, and I often ask a clarification question, I try to do it as in a big bulk email because I don't like sending individual emails saying, okay, well, I don't understand this on page 45. And then going back to him 100 pages later, said, what is this? I like putting it all together. I like doing the entire book and then sending one email. Yeah. So, and he didn't, you know, that was the only time with him. So it varies from author to author.
And I know that Martin actually knew the book pretty well before he started out doing the translation. So because it had been out in Denmark for some years and I've done so many interviews and it had been all over. So that also makes a difference because then you know what the writer, the author is actually thinking about this work. And you have, you've been reading about it in magazines and stuff. So he knew the work already. I think also that helps to know what the...
Yeah, you also have, you do have the safety net of the editor that works on it, too. And editing translations is not quite as... it's not quite as intense as editing a book that was written in English, where you tend to rephrase things or shift things or tell people to cut endings. But I've, as an editor, cut parts of books before or had someone rewrite sections of them because they just weren't working. So you do have that element as well. So you have the translator that's doing their part, and then the first reader of that translation outside of the author and translator is the editor who has to say well, this is great, but when you're you say that there's nothing stilted, that's the editor's job, is to make sure that that doesn't happen.
And copy editors are often the unsung heroes of the publishing industry, I think, and that's absolutely true, because they're the first line of defense. If there's something that's awkward or weird, they'll let you know about it, and so that's great.
I just want to read a quick email from Robin. Just said, Evan, heard a snippet while driving but missed. Where and when is this author, Josephine, reading tonight? So Josephine is going to be at, Chad Post, take it away. What's going on tonight?
She's going to be at Knox Cocktail Lounge, which is in Village Gate, at 6 p.m. She will read. She'll be there to hang out and talk with readers and meet with anyone who comes.
Okay. And ultimately, if you're just hearing about Read Local, I love the idea. Kyle, it could grow into what? What's the vision for what Read Local ends up being?
You know, I'm going to pull a Joe Flaherty here and say, I don't necessarily have a vision necessarily for that. He was on here before the summer, and he said more or less the same. And for me, it's I want it to be something where people celebrate local publishers and recognize that Rochester is home to an amazing literary community. And it really is. And that's one of the things that I'm really excited about being here. There are so many people, so many writers. I mean, just translators alone. I mean, Chad mentioned Carey, but Lytton Smith is here, and he translated from Icelandic. A lot of good translators, a lot of good writers, publishers, and it just seems very rich here. And I guess I just want to celebrate the local, the people who do the publishing. Publishing is a very difficult.
And thankless
industry. And really, for those who are so passionate about books, about literature, I just want to be able to say, here, let's celebrate you. Let's, you're doing some good stuff. Let's just honor you for that. Because, many people are not honoring them. They're forgotten in all of this. It's like a book comes out 6 months later, it's either doing well or it's dead. But we can at least say, you know what, you guys are here, you're doing great work, keep it up, that kind of stuff.
Sure. We have about 90 seconds left. I just want to ask Josephine Klaugaard, author of One of Us is Sleeping, who is here in Rochester. You've probably heard from some readers on a book like this that has this much emotion, this much texture to it. What is the kind of feedback you've gotten for this book?
Oh, I have got so much great feedback. I think that a lot of people has told me that it kind of changed them, and I think that that's one of the beautiful things about literature. Sometimes you recognize yourself in the literature, but what's really important is that you're not the same person when you're done reading a book. So, you know, it's not like you got some quick answers, but you're a wiser person when it comes to some of the crucial aspects of life, and you have had some experiences of beauty and meaning, not anything that can translate easily. So it's not that you can say, okay, I gained this or this from reading it, but you've just grown, and you've just added some images to your this hierarchy of great remembered memorable images that kind of build you up as a human being.
Well, thanks for being here. I've really enjoyed it. It's a great way to end our week here on Connections. The book is called One of Us is Sleeping. Chad Post, for our listeners who want to pick up this and other translated books, open letter books, where can they go, Chad?
Most of the books are available in local bookstores, local Barnes & Noble. You can also go and buy them from your favorite online retailer or from our website, which is openletterbooks.org.
Openletterbooks.org. Tonight, Knox, 6 p.m., free. Josephine, Jakob, you're going to be there as well. Where else would you be, man?
Yeah,
there, you'll be there. Kyle will be there. Chad will be there. It's Read Local. Good luck with that. Great fun. And thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Josephine, Jakob, great meeting you. Thanks for being here.
Too.
Chad, thanks to John Anderson, the engineer of this broadcast, and our outstanding producer, Megan Mack. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk with you Monday on member-supported public radio.